Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room. Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Well, I'm Al Warren, and on the line is Kev Thompson.
I'm here.
Again. And we're talking to the retired Seattle Chief of Police, and we're glad he's here. Norm Stampler, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
Wow. So I was listening to your book, of course, because I'm getting too old to read, and To Protect and Serve and How to Fix America's Police. So, wow, I you know, I was really surprised by most of the book. I didn't expect to hear what I heard from you. But, you know, in a way, that's kind of what the book is about. What made you go to write this book? What was it that drove you to write this?
Well, I wrote an earlier book after I retired. It came out in 2005 called Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. And it was this person's attempt to outline the problems associated with policing in America. And the new book is more prescriptive. The first one was described by my publisher as part polemic and part procedural. And the idea really was to write a new book that would focus on the problems that we have seen since Ferguson, which was, the incident itself occurred on August the 9th, 2014.
So when you have issues like Ferguson and the way the media has kind of rallied with one point of view and lots of groups, how does that make you feel as a cop, and how does it put a lot of pressure on police in general? Do they feel like they're being watched now?
Well, I have been, even as a member of the institution for 34 years in my adult life, a critic of that institution. I think there is much in public criticism of law enforcement that is valid. Many officers feel the same way. But we're stuck in a system. We're stuck in a cycle, really, of behavior that is not always helpful to us. So I think there's that. But there's also the reality that police officers are human, and that when they are criticized as severely and as broadly as they have been criticized as a group for the last 3 or 4 years, it certainly wears on them, and actually absent constructive alternatives adds to the problem.
Now I noticed in Chapter 5, your title was Scared Cop is a Dangerous Cop. And maybe explain that a little bit.
Sure. I think anybody who thinks about police work would say, well, that's a dangerous job. Just to set the stage here for a quick moment, policing is dangerous. It is hard work. It's delicate. It's demanding. Police officers are moving from one kind of a call to a very different kind of call in the next 30 seconds, for example. So it's a tough, tough job. But it's not nearly as dangerous as most people think. Policing does not even enter the top 10 of the most dangerous jobs in the country. If you're really attracted to danger, the job to take would be crab fishing in the Bering Sea in the middle of winter. That's a dangerous job. So is logging, so is construction, so is agriculture, so is sanitation and firefighting and the like. But there is something quite different about injuries and deaths to police officers because they are often at the hands of other human beings. So I've made the assertion, based on a really firm belief and a lot of experience, that scared cops tend to be impulsive. They tend not to see straight, literally. I mean, fear affects perception, and fear affects judgment. So we wind up in situations too often in which a police officer, who is experiencing very understandable levels of fear, has not learned to manage it. And I think the conclusion of that chapter is there are lots of ways that we can help police officers recognize fear in themselves, name it internally, of course, and manage it effectively in the moment. We hear a lot, for example, about de-escalation these days. It's important to teach police officers crisis intervention and de-escalation. Really, de-escalation starts or should with the officer himself or herself.
Yeah, absolutely, because the scene is already out of control, or the officer wouldn't be there. So now he's got to come in and set the tone.
I could not agree more. An officer who shows up at a tense situation where tempers have flared, people themselves are frightened or enraged, and you've got emotions percolating at a very, very high level, a police officer who enters that kind of a situation can peacefully reduce that tension, or he can escalate it. And too often, jumping out of the car and screaming at the top of one's lungs for people to start behaving properly and to, obey the law and so on and so forth is not helpful. What's helpful is a calm, mature, professional police officer who's possessed of a body of knowledge and a set of skills as well as experience that will help them bring to a peaceful and safe conclusion those kinds of tensions.
How much of that is lack of training?
You know, we did discover after Ferguson that police officers on average throughout the country are given in the neighborhood of 60 hours of training in firearms and about 2 hours of what we would today call de-escalation training. And oftentimes it's not really that. It's more interpersonal relations, the need to be polite and courteous and not use profanity and so on and so forth. So there's been that discrepancy. And a lot of departments have heard that criticism, have accepted it, and in fact are beginning to shrink that ratio of firearms, defensive tactics training to de-escalation training.
Well, and the other thing I noticed you talked about was how, I believe it was 80% of the police are not in good shape.
I think that's a reasonable figure. It's a guesstimate.
Right.
But in point of fact, if you look at the lifestyle of the average police officer today, and I think it's better in some respects, every once in a while we'll see a police officer who is the exception to this rule, that police officers are not drinking as much. Many of them have stopped smoking, if in fact they ever smoked. They are working out as opposed to going out for six beers after work. So there's a healthy trend developing within policing. But we still have far too many officers who, put simply, are out of shape. And if you're out of shape physically, that feeds kind of emotional problems. It feeds the tendency on the part of a police officer who recognizes his limitations. I can't really chase this, 23-year-old down this block at 3 o'clock in the morning. I can't really do my job the way I used to do it. So it's really important that police officers be in good physical condition and good health and good physical condition.
Yeah, Kevin?
Yeah, I've got to admit, I've got to agree. I mean, now, me personally, I'm in great shape, Round is the shape.
Yep.
I've worked on the correction side, and we have inmates in there that do nothing but work out. They work on their physiques. They build strength 24 hours a day. Then they get into a conflict, and about 50% of our officers, by the time they get to the fight, are winded. And we're not talking chasing somebody down the street. We're talking running down a hallway to a dorm.
Well, I can tell you that I have worked, this getting a little personal here, I have worked with two police chiefs who, by anybody's definition, would be described as overweight and most likely out of shape. Each of them was an outstanding police officer. So generalizations are just that. They're generalizations. You want to look at a specific individual, make a judgment about that individual, great. I do believe that, in general, the entire workforce would benefit from a sane and sensible program of physical fitness. And I think diet, nutrition, sleep is a critical factor, by the way. Police officers who are working, let's say, 3 in the morning till 11 in the morning are already experiencing the kinds of metabolism and other issues that experts tell us are just not healthy for those officers. Then they go to court, and maybe they've got a second job, very much in the news these days, and they may be serving as a flagger or something at a parking garage, and they're basically at work for most of their waking hours. That's not the way we are built as human beings. We do the work. We come home, we relax, we de-stress, we enjoy family and friends, we enjoy our films or our books or whatever it is that takes our mind off the work we do, and then we get a good night or a good day's sleep. And that's just not part of the picture for probably most police officers.
So you think it's okay that the mayor wants to get rid of that graveyard or moonlighting?
Well, that's two different things. That graveyard shift, as you refer to it, I don't think is a healthy shift.
Right.
Simply because we know that most officers are not going to go right to sleep when they get off that shift. They're going to work, or they're going to be otherwise involved, and they're not going to get as much sleep as they need. If individuals do in fact accommodate that shift, that's fine. That's a whole nother matter. But many do not. But I also think that officers working off duty, I will tell you, I experienced culture shock when I came from the San Diego Police Department, where I'd worked for 28 years. We never had police officers in uniform working off duty jobs. I get to Seattle, and of course I wasn't completely blindsided. I'd done my homework, and my police officers in their Seattle police uniforms are directing traffic, providing security outside a nightclub, perhaps even inside that nightclub. And that really did come as a culture shock to me. So I think it's a very delicate issue. It does represent a past practice that's been underway for decades in this city and many other cities in different parts of the country as well.
Now,
down here in the South in Alabama as well.
You bet.
Well, now you mention a lot and talk about the drug war on drugs, save money, save lives. Maybe go over what you think your feelings are on the war on drugs.
Well, when Richard Nixon, we've always had, you know, in modern history, narcotics laws on the books. And police officers and departments across the country have enforced those drug laws. But they've done them as a normal course of activity. For example, patrol officers during their shift. They encounter somebody back in the day with a half a baggie of marijuana, that's an arrest. They encounter somebody with heroin or cocaine, LSD, what have you, that's an arrest. But that's all that it is. When Richard Nixon famously proclaimed drug abuse public enemy number one and declared all-out war on drugs, he was actually declaring war on his own people. and disproportionately young people, poor people, and people of color, the very people who historically have had the most strained relationship with police, and vice versa. And so what he did is, in effect, put police officers as foot soldiers on the front line of this war, thereby heightening that tension, deepening the conflict between community and police. We have spent $1.5 trillion prosecuting the war. Drugs are more readily available today at lower prices and higher levels of potency than any time since Nixon declared that war. So it's a colossal failure in terms of public policy, but it also does such damage, not just to the community police relationship, which is very, very significant, but to families, to communities, to individuals, people arrested for nonviolent low-level drug offenses have their lives affected for the rest of those lives, and not in a good way. So I'm convinced that it's time to end the drug war, to replace the bankrupt public policy of prohibition, which we know from 1920 to 1933 did not work all that well with alcohol.
It was an utter failure.
Utter failure. In fact, what it did is give rise to the kind of Al Capone-level violence that we saw in, not just in Chicago, but cities across the country. So the drug war is actually producing, in many respects, exactly the opposite results that we want. We want to see public safety. We want to see neighborhood health. We want individuals who, by definition, are sick to get help. So if we were to structure U.S. drug policy along the lines of a public health model, provide medical assistance rather than the criminal justice model and arrest as the answer to drug use or drug abuse, then we, I think, find ourselves almost overnight in a healthier place.
Mm. Now, one thing I was reading, and I see this on 60 Minutes, they just talked about this, how in the U.S. we have 2.3 million Americans locked up. And they say it's a cost of $182 billion per year. And, you know, it's higher than any other nation. And in fact, we have less people studying in college than we do in prison. So do you attribute a lot of that to the war on drugs?
I certainly do. I think there are a lot of arrests that are made. For example, reasonable suspicion is developed, drug possession, that sort of thing. That arrest is made. Behind that arrest, we learn that this particular individual, for example, is financing his fixes by stealing from others. Burglary, robbery, auto theft, car prowl, and then fencing property. So we find that there are a lot of other crimes that are associated with drug use and certainly drug trafficking. So, yeah, that's true. I mean, we are home to 5% of the world's population and 25% of its inmates, to echo your earlier point.
Now, how do we recover from that? Because I'm willing to admit, you know, again, working in the corrections field for 20 plus years, about 80% of our inmate census is in there for some type of drug crime. But like you said, they commit other crimes in order to finance their drug habits. However, and ironically, we're closing down a lot of our mental health facilities. It doesn't make sense to me. It's almost like we're cutting off our nose to spite our face. So how do we get government officials to see this? You know, I don't feel that the average addict needs to be put in jail. We can't handle that. We can't handle the detox, and we can't handle the psychological factors that come along with addiction. And quite honestly, that's getting us in trouble, guys. So how do we reconcile this? So what should we do?
I think the American people, and oftentimes it is the people at the grassroots level, who are way out ahead of their public officials. They have more insight. They have more understanding. They're more closely connected to the problems in their own neighborhoods. I think the American people need to rise up and insist on an end to the drug war. And in fact, I prescribe 8 things that we can do as a nation to improve police practices, but also to achieve higher levels of public safety and neighborhood health. But I think we need to say enough. End the drug war, replace that prohibition model with a regulatory model, and rigorously enforce it. You cannot drive a car while impaired, whether it's booze or any other drug. You cannot furnish to a minor. And by the way, you cannot hide behind your your intoxication or your drug use to excuse away those other crimes, whether it be domestic violence or rape or child abuse or any other offense. Well, I'm sorry, I was drunk, or I was high, or I was under the influence of some substance. I think we hold people accountable for behavior, not the status offense. The status offense being, possession of any kind of illicit substance. And the American people can lead that fight by putting pressure at the state level, which certainly we've done with marijuana in probably a dozen states now, Colorado and Washington, the first 2 states a few years back, to legalize marijuana for adult recreational use, put limits on that, provide for a regulatory system to control it. And it's just so much smarter. It's cheaper. And frankly, it's also a revenue generator. Now, I've been in interesting conversations with libertarians who say we cannot, finance government's use of those regulatory systems for philosophical, frankly, reasons. And I would call nonsense on that. We can and we must. The regulatory system provides for purity. It provides for strength of dosage. It requires, appropriate packaging. It requires keeping those products away from kids. And it also provides revenue for prevention, education, and training. And treatment. So, I mean, it is, to use the cliche, a win-win proposition.
Yeah, Norm, I agree with you. Quite honestly, just us guys talking, I can't wait till it's legal.
Well, and I have to say, across the border now, because I go there so often, they've taken that response with heroin now as well, right?
Uh-oh.
They've got the mobile units set up now, and the free shots. You can go in and get the needles. They give you clean heroin that isn't with all the other drugs that are killing you. You have to stay there while they watch to make sure that you have a good reaction. And that's sort of where they're spending their money, where they used to spend it on arresting those people.
Right.
So now I don't know that that's the answer, but they seem to be handling the problem better. I guess it's a Band-Aid.
It is a harm reduction approach to the drug problem in a local community. Clean needles, needle exchanges, safe injection or supervised injection sites where, in fact, you create hygienic conditions and medical experts are overseeing the administration of the drug. If you are a heroin addict, you are a sick person, mm-hmm. and you need medical treatment. In all likelihood, you would benefit from psychological counseling and other kinds of, employment counseling and the like. One of the things that we know about heroin is that the only way you can get it in most Western industrialized nations is, in fact, by stealing it or prostituting yourself to get enough money for it or dealing drugs yourself. Or, as I mentioned earlier, stealing from innocent people, violating their privacy, their sanctity, oftentimes stealing, items of great value, including sentimental value. I mean, theft is a very serious crime in my book. And heroin addicts, because they know that they can't be gainfully employed, they're living chaotic and pretty miserable lives. They lose friends, they lose family, they lose home, they lose employment, they lose, in some cases, public assistance and the like. So what do we do about that? Well, if we were to create, for example, the Vancouver model, which is under consideration in Seattle and King County, and I think that's long overdue and a wonderful step in the right direction. We can, in fact, produce predictability and stability in the lives of heroin addicts. It's not the answer. It's not the cure. But I would describe it as more than a Band-Aid, a term that oftentimes is used. Because it, one of the things we know about heroin and addiction is that there are people who can achieve a maintenance level of heroin in their system and live otherwise healthy lives. We have seen that. Mm-hmm. People addicted to opioids at a low level of consumption whose lives seem to an outsider perfectly normal. And that means that they have reached that magic maintenance level. There's so many people who just don't want to hear this conversation at all. It's like, wait, you are advocating. No, I'm not. I'm certainly not advocating marijuana or heroin or LSD or cocaine or PCP or crack cocaine use. I'm not advocating any of that at all. I think what we're talking about is recognizing an age-old problem that's always been, always will represent a reality in our lives, and trying to do something sensible from a public policy point of view.
Yeah. Well, you know, I see it all the time with Vancouver, and it seems to be working as a model. There's doctors, they've had very few problems with, you know, with the people coming in for heroin. There's not like they're assaulting anybody or doing anything. So seems to be working out okay. But I don't know. Yeah, I really don't know if it's the answer.
I have visited InSight, Lower East Side, Vancouver. Mm-hmm. I've read extensively about the Zurich model in Switzerland, where in that particular model, heroin addicts come into a facility that is, once again, a medically supervised, clean facility. The heroin is actually provided by the government in that country. And we've seen, I'll make up this cohort because I don't know what the actual number is. Let's say there are 300 people that formerly lived in Needle Park, living that chaotic life, living miserable lives, and risking other people's lives as well. Stick injuries from a dirty syringe. Police officers oftentimes encounter that. Drug overdose deaths, people stepping over bodies in so-called Needle Park. And then they said, well, that's not working. They tried something. Let's put all the heroin addicts in this one area. But it became very obvious very quickly that that wasn't the answer. So they came up with the safe and supervised injection site with the government actually providing the heroin. And of those 300 people, it's something like 66% found employment within a very short period of time. A number of them got married. A number of them went back to school, if in fact they had been going to school, and turned their lives around. They're still heroin addicts. It's like, high-functioning alcoholics or high-functioning addicts of any kind. But they're not robbing banks. They're not stealing from you and me and our neighbors. They're not popping the window of our Toyotas and breaking into our cars to get any kind of property they can that they can fence for a nickel or a quarter or 50 cents on a dollar and finance that next fix. It's a healthier, smarter way to go.
Now, Norm, I'm going to weigh in here, and me and Al, we've had this discussion. And Al, you know what I'm fixing to say. At some point, though, let me start with this. Are we actually curing the person of their addiction, or are we enabling it? Are we simply moving them from this side of the line over here to this? I'm listening to the benefits, and I agree with you. Because a lot of those crimes tend to be very, very personal. You know, you're stealing from your grandmother, or you're stealing from your parents.
Yep.
Or if I'm the victim of a theft, you know, I take that very, very seriously. I feel invaded. But But at the same time, by the government handing out needles and clean heroin, I understand it. I get it. I really, really do. But are we really helping the person, or are we enabling them to continue down a self-destructive path?
I would say this, and it's a very legitimate question, that we are not enabling them. What we are doing is attempting to create the kinds of conditions where if they want to be cured of an addiction, if they want a rehabilitated life, they can do that. Under the circumstances of the vast majority of heroin addicts today who are living in shooting galleries and in doorways and urinating and defecating in front of businesses and the like and looking to score that next fix, we're transforming that picture into one in which there's an opportunity for them to develop some self-respect, to develop some positive, healthy habits. And as a result of that, perhaps, and certainly not with every one of them, they will, in fact, become gainfully employed, that they will, in fact, live healthier lives, reducing the social and financial impact on communities, and they will, in fact, be in a position where if they want to kick, they can kick. And it's just not likely to happen if they're constantly under the influence of too great a level of heroin, at the mercy of whatever ratio of the mix, between, for example, baking soda and pure heroin, because you don't want to shoot pure heroin if you're an addict, or if you're not, you don't want to shoot it because it'll kill you. Addicts don't become more and more addicted. They are addicted. Let's start with that baseline. They are addicted. And the question is, are they scoring dirty heroin at dosage levels that are,
dangerous,
bound to kill? So I'm just saying what we're doing is recognizing the reality of the life of a heroin addict and attempting to improve that. For that reason, I wouldn't call it enabling.
Yeah. Now, another thing I noticed in your book, you talk a lot about the rise of the militarization of the police force. And, how it started really in the 60s and 70s, Black Panther and Patty Hearst and the SWAT and all that. How do you feel is it going too far nowadays? Or are we going too far with too much?
We are, I'm convinced, absolutely going too far. Let me first offer, and this is not a disclaimer, this is an expression of reality. There are times and places and circumstances that demand military-like appearance, weaponry, vehicles, military-like tactics. I had the experience as an assistant chief in San Diego of rolling on the McDonald's massacre in July of 1984. 21 moms and dads and children dead. At the hands of James Huberty, who ultimately was taken out by our SWAT shooter, our sniper. Had we an armored personnel carrier, for example, driven that vehicle up to the door of, or even through the door of the McDonald's, we no doubt could have taken Huberty out earlier. We could have reduced the carnage. So no one will ever convince me that seeing a police officer in military-like garb with military-like weapons and employing military-like tactics is bad, that it's somehow un-American. There are times and places for that, and I can't stress that too much. At the same time, when we trot out all that equipment, when uniformed and weaponized police officers with ballistic helmets and protective gear from head to toe show up, at somebody's front door on a pre-dawn drug raid because a confidential and reliable informant saw somebody with a half a baggie of marijuana entering that apartment or home the day before, we've gone too far. We have absolutely gone too far. And in fact, the Tactical Officers Association of America has taken a position that we should not use SWAT and those tactics for drug raids at all. We should not be doing drug raids at all. Their position is this: I will risk my life for a citizen. I will risk my life for a fellow officer. I will not risk my life for drugs. And it seems just so logical that we end those drug raids, find other ways, if we are committed to the drug war, find other ways to make those arrests. It's dangerous, and it is shattering to individuals, so traumatizing to individuals to hear a battering ram at 5:30 in the morning take out your front door, officers, you know, streaming in, 10, 12, 14 of them, and screaming, and oftentimes firing, shooting family pets, shooting innocent people, sometimes getting shot for their trouble, their own selves. I think it's just really important that we think about the message we're sending and the dangers that we're elevating with these pre-dawn drug raids. And it's so common. It used to be 3,000 a year. Estimates by experts like Radley Balko and Peter Kraska of Eastern Kentucky have it at 50 to 60,000 of these raids. The lion's share of those could be eliminated if we got smart about police policies and tactics.
Another thing I noticed, too, was when you talk about, and this is something I hear a lot, you know, about police using too much force, like a shooting instead of using a taser, or why don't they shoot them in the leg? Why don't they shoot the gun out of the hand? Which that made me laugh in the book, because how you said, well, that's, you know, that's just like a Western, you know, on TV. It's true. So is there, how do you respond to that, first of all, with the, you know, why don't they shoot them in the leg?
Police officers are taught, and I'll explain the rationale in just a second, but the police officers are taught to shoot for center mass. You're shooting to stop the threat. Let's say that I approach you with a firearm. I am essentially issuing threats. I'm going to shoot you. I'm going to kill you, whatever. And you see the gun in my hand, and in fact, I point it at you. That's not the time for negotiation. That's the time for you to pull your weapon mm-hmm. and pull its trigger and to stop that threat. So you are taught that if you shoot somebody in the legs and they've got a handgun, they can still take you out. You can shoot somebody in the head and still be shot by return fire from that individual. It has happened. People say, yeah, you know, that's nonsense. That doesn't happen. Well, it does. It certainly doesn't happen all day, every day in cities across this country, but it does happen. And on the strength of that knowledge, police officers are taught to shoot for center mass. Typically, they're taught double tap, which is from a semi-automatic weapon. You fire twice. If the threat is ended, you holster your firearm and you approach the individual. And if you're a professional police officer, you render first aid if that person is, in fact, no longer a threat. And you hope, having attempted to, in effect, take a life, that maybe you can save a life.
You are correct.
Well, thank you.
You are absolutely correct.
He thanks you for your approval.
I do thank you. I do believe that we have a problem in this country with excessive force. From ratcheting down on the handcuffs just a little bit too hard, from not protecting a prisoner's head, putting them into a squad car, encouraged, by the way, by the President of the United States, which I found, it, as did many other police officials across the country, appalling. And many of those immediately issued pronouncements to their officers, listen to me, because I'm your boss. And putting it bluntly, Donald Trump is not your boss, and he tends to say things that are not only irrational, but utterly irresponsible. Yeah. So I think we have this problem, not in every department, not every officer, but far too many departments and far too many officers, who believe we're the cops and you're not, and we will decide what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and when we're going to do it. There's an arrogance certainly attached to that, but there's also that's also a function of training. Officers are trained to be in control at all times. You don't turn away from a fight. You never lose. Yeah. You never lose a fight. You know this from working as a corrections official. You can't lose a fight. Well, that mentality has caused officers to lean into dangerous situations when the smart thing, tactically, the life-saving thing very well might be to retreat, not to run down the street and hide behind a building, but rather to take cover, to create time that allows you to assess the situation and respond in a more even, even-handed and smarter fashion.
Yeah. Now, let me weigh in on a couple of things here that we've kind of breezed past, because I'm with you. You know, we've had so many instances of excessive force, and the media is going to take and run with it. But let's go back to the beginning of our discussion when we're talking about de-escalation. And when I do training courses for our academy, I'm a talker. I am a talker. If I can talk my way out of a problem, I will do it. You know, as evidenced by the fact that I co-host a show with Al. I'm a talker. You know, and pardon the crudity here, but I teach my cadets, don't let your cojones outweigh your brains. And do you think, you were talking about officers that are kind of scared, you know, you watch them, they walk into dorms with trepidation and that fear in their eyes, and they don't know how to talk. We've taught them how to fight. We've taught them how to shoot. We've taught them how to tase. We've taught them how to spray. But like you said, we only spend maybe a couple of hours on IPC skills or interpersonal communication skills. Maybe that's why we're having such problems with excessive force, because once that adrenaline kicks in and you realize that, you know, hey, you know, poop's fixing to get real here, they will overcorrect. They will overdo things rather than, like you said, not run, but we teach them disengage. I tell them disengage, get your back up, and then go back in. Do you think that it's a problem with training, or this is an angle we haven't discussed yet? Maybe this is something we need in our vetting system or in our filtering system during the application phase. Are you able to de-escalate before we waste a lot of time on you and send you out in the field with a weapon?
I will tell you this. The problem is not training. It is not the selection process, both of which are critically important to the success of a police officer, to the effectiveness of a police officer. I would never quarrel with recommendations that call for strengthening the screening process, for improving the training. I would always support that. I think that makes infinite good sense. What I would contend, though, is that the problem is embedded in the culture of policing. The culture is a product of the structure of policing, which is paramilitary, bureaucratic, command and control, top down. Oftentimes, we treat police officers organizationally as dependent or delinquent children, even as we're expecting them to act as mature and respected adults. I think we need to change, improve the workplace culture. If we have police officers, for example, who upon getting out of the car, immediately confront in belligerent fashion individuals on a maybe a disturbance call or whatever it might happen to be, then that is a function certainly of their training. And by the way, not all training is done in the classroom. Some of it's done in the front seat of a police car, and a lot of it's done in the locker room. So that gets once again back to the culture of policing. Two or three things have to happen. Number one, I think Police officers must be made to understand that the protection and preservation of human life is their number one priority. A mentality that says, on this call that I'm rolling on right now, once I arrive at my destination, nobody dies. I don't die. Fellow officers don't die. The people I've been called to arrest or to help don't die. It's an attitude that we can ingrain, I think, of police officers that will help them not only with officer safety. You see, the impulsive officers not only are more dangerous to the community, they themselves, through their impulsiveness and fear, set up these situations, and they wind up getting injured or worse. So I think we need to look at the culture, and we need to understand that it's okay to set non-negotiable standards for performance and conduct. It's okay to say, if you can't or won't follow department policy, law, if you will not honor the Constitution of this country, we don't want you. There's the door. And I think we need to do more of that in police work.
Wow.
Honestly, Norm, I'm going to kind of challenge you here just a little bit, you know, politely.
Please do.
I know prior to corrections, you know, I worked out on the streets. I worked undercover. And there was no time that I can remember of rolling up on a scene saying that I'm going to kill somebody.
Yeah,
now, if the opportunity presented itself and I felt like my life was in danger, what am I supposed to do?
Very different thought, mentality behind, I'm going to kill somebody today, and nobody dies today. It's essentially the opposite of that first notion. I agree with you completely. I have never worked with a police officer who's given off those signs. Today, I'm going to kill somebody. On this call, I'm going to kill somebody. Now, we did have a situation recently in which an officer, the officer's voice is captured on audio and video.
Right.
And that is, I'm going to kill this blank.
Right.
And 5 seconds later, he does exactly what he said he did. I got to tell you, to my way of thinking, even if the circumstances are complicated and maybe even a little hazy or murky, when you say, I'm going to kill somebody, and then you kill them, and you have not been directly threatened, that's cold-blooded murder. And that has happened. It's happened in Chicago in the form of the Laquan McDonald shooting, in which Jason Van Dyke approaches and follows this 17-year-old kid, who does have a knife in his hand, by the way, and has cut police tires, so he's not a goody two-shoes, but he's walking away from Van Dyke. And Van Dyke shoots him not once, but 16 times. Continues to pump round after round into this 17-year-old who's now prone on the asphalt. 6 or 7 other officers, by the way, all of their firearms holstered,
yes,
watching this. Walter Scott.
Very tragic.
Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, wanted for child support violation, runs away from Michael Slager, a police officer in that city, and gets shot in the back. Now, both of these, because they were videoed, have become, how do I put it? You know, if you're listening to a police spokesperson, police chief, sheriff, PIO, standing behind a bank of microphones at a lectern, talking about the tragedy of this particular shooting or that particular shooting, you're going to hear or maybe read about an incident. But seeing it, that is inviting white middle-class people, putting it bluntly, to see something, to experience something vicariously that black families, for example, have experienced for generations. Being stopped repeatedly. Ron Sims, former county executive, talks about having been stopped, I think it was 8 times, for no apparent reason. He acknowledges that there was one time when maybe he was guilty of a traffic violation. But the other times, it's like, who are you and what are you doing here? Why are you in this car? as a black man. That gets stretched so thin, creates so much tension, and unnecessarily in black communities across the country. So I think it's an attitude shift that we need. It's a cultural shift that we need.
Do you think race is a problem, or is it just, is it the situation of a lot of black and minorities being in poor neighborhoods?
It's a combination of things, and anybody who would say otherwise, I think, needs to you know, add a little to his or her education. Clearly, poor neighborhoods experience greater levels of street-level problems. Open-air drug markets, hand-to-hand deals, street prostitution, used condoms, dirty syringes. That paints a picture, for example, that causes folks like Bill Bratton in New York to say, we need a broken windows theory behind our policy. Let's look out for the small things. The big things will take care of themselves. I mean, it's fundamentally racist to allow, as a government, to allow streets in a black neighborhood to experience deterioration, for street lights to dim and go out and never be replaced, and those kinds of things. We need to pay attention to the factors that help create feelings of health and safety in neighborhoods. And certainly we have seen police officers more likely to make arrests of young black people, mostly men, in black neighborhoods as opposed to white men in white neighborhoods on drug issues. Simply because even though white drug use and white drug sales are equal to, if not greater, in many neighborhoods than they are in the black communities. But if the transactions are taking place in a more public place, officers are naturally going to be drawn to it. Sometimes they are asked by that very neighborhood, please put an end to that open-air market across the street from me. I can't send my kids out to play. My property values are plummeting. Quality of life is, you know, horrific. And we can all, community and police, work together in sensible ways to improve those conditions and thereby reduce crime in those neighborhoods.
Wow. Well, we can certainly hope things get better. And so we are quickly running out of time. So, Norm, your book, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. They can get that in any bookstore, I guess.
They can.
And do you have any contact information if people want to make a comment or send you some information?
Sure. NormStamper.com is my website. I don't have a link directly to me because I live kind of a life of solitude in my cabin on a mountain. And I say that to rub it in for those who are still commuting. And experiencing the traffic we have around these parts. Yeah. But I prize that. But you will find on my website a connection to the publicist of my publisher, and she will get in touch with me. And I'd be delighted to hear any feedback.
Well, fantastic. And, of course, we'll have you linked to our website as well and your book. Thank you for being here with us.
Al, my pleasure. Thank you.